and welcome to the Trash Tapes Podcast as part of the Enigmatic Productions Network. If you love bad cinema and incredible deep dives into cult film, then you have come to the right place. So if you like what you hear and want to support us, you can do so by donating some funds to our Buy Me a Coffee website, along with the Acast supporter feature. All of these can be found in the description below. And now, on with the show.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Movie buffs and cinephiles, and welcome to another episode of the Not So Trash Reviews. My name is Johan Chapal, your host, soundtrack addict, and appreciator of high quality headphones. This episode is one that I'm really excited for, as I get to delve into part of the film production that I adore: sound design. It is one that is sometimes overlooked, but has full deep history and meaning behind the process, with a fine balance of technical skill and creative flair. Having formerly worked as a sound designer and recorder for various projects, it is a field that I still have a lot of passion for, and been wanting to discuss this in detail for quite some time. And so, for this, I brought in post-sound engineer William Henley to talk shop with me, as well as analyse our film for today, Peter Strickland's sonic exploration of psychological terror, Barbarian Sound Studio.
Excuse me, do you speak?
No.
A new world of sound awaits here. A new world that requires all your magic powers.
I didn't quite know I'd be working on this sort of film.
What did you expect?
What's he doing to her? I've never worked on a horror film before.
Horror film? This is a Santini film. Don't call my film horror again.
This is going to be a fantastic film.
Brutal and honest.
I try my best to do my work, and it's never good enough.
Do what I tell you.
Am I clear?
I'm just a whore to them. I feel so dirty and cheap.
Who's there? Who's there? I will call the police.
You never stop to ask why they hired you. It doesn't make you curious.
I think you're forgetting this is not your studio.
And I'm joined by Will. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. How are we?
We're doing good at the moment. Although as we're recording this right now, it is a storm outside. So if especially this being an audio podcast, if you suddenly hear gusts of wind, you know why. But I think this will help today for the movie we're going to be talking about, where it's predominantly about sound. Let's add that little atmosphere by having horrible sounding wind effects. And you did joke that you live right next to a very busy road, so if we hear cars, we know why.
Yeah. If you hear police sirens or ambulances, it's not that like someone's having an accident outside. It's Marianne. Don't worry about it.
There we go. So for those who are... So I got you on because, one, you suggested that let's do one, but then I thought to myself, huh, okay, if we're going to do one together, I think we need to do something that kind of reflects both our interests here, because you are a sound designer.
Yes, I am. So my official title that I give myself is post audio engineer. Mm-hmm. But what that basically means is I work on everything behind a computer. So usually, like, sometimes there's a range of things, but I mostly specialize in film and sound design for film. Mm. And for over 3 years now, I've been working predominantly in film, doing sound mixes, sound design, cleanup dialogue, audio, you name it, I've done it.
Yeah, so all the post-production, basically.
All the post-production, whether I'm doing Foley and making sort of the sound effects that you hear when someone's driving a car, to just taking the audio that's recorded on set and cleaning up and mixing it in with the re-recorded sounds.
I've worked mostly in sound as well, and so it's so surprising sometimes how it's so important how to fix up that sound to make the world feel lived in. And this is the weird thing for it. It's very bizarre because sound to me is like one of the most important things of a movie, because if you can't hear it well, you're not going to be immersed in it. But it doesn't feel like it gets the same amount of respect as someone like a cinematographer or a director.
No, yeah, it's like really, I always say like sound design is 75% of the film. Mm. It's a really big chunk of what really adds, because you have to build a world where the film is set, and you have to add all these little touches and these impacts to drive points home. Like if we got a real sound of, let's say, someone punching someone, it's not going to be impressive, and you're not going to feel the effect and the impact and violence of it. That's why we have sound design and sound bits, is to touch up on that and make it really, really drive home.
I wanted to ask, actually, from some of the movies you've worked on, were there any challenges in your sound design? Like, were there any moments you sat there going, this is going to be difficult, what can I do? What kind of problem scenarios have you had as a sound designer?
As a sound designer, the most sort of like problematic things is when I get, like, I always say that I prefer doing fantasy and science fiction, and the films where you have to use your imagination a bit, because obviously there you get to play around, you have a little bit of breathing room. But films that are more set sort of realistic, they're the ones I can sometimes struggle with sometimes, because it's like there's not a lot of creativity that I can have, and a lot of the times the director or the producer will just say, yeah, but I just kind of want to keep it simple. And so I feel like in more realistic films, I'm a bit restricted.
Sometimes this is a thing, like we as sound designers have to be the one to provide them with a new energy, because the director and the writers and everyone else who's maybe coming in afterwards, even the producers and other people, by sitting there going like, I don't know how to approach the sound design for this. And they will usually say, like you said, like, keep it simple. We want a little bit of this, but they don't know how to describe it. So we have to do quite a bit of heavy work, don't we?
We basically act as like translators sometimes. We have to find the, like, we have to, like, you understand the common language there. Working. Like, we want this to be like really, you know what I mean? I'll be like, okay, I understand.
What is
Yeah. And you have to just go, okay, so I'm assuming what he might want is something like this, and therefore I will try and implement this technique to that effect.
Which is why sound design in most cases is probably the most creative approach in some of the things there. Yes, you have editing, which provides a different thing, and you have the cinematography, but sound as a whole is the final step of making your very own unique creativity, because you don't actually, unless the director's also been a sound person before, which is rare, actually, but if they have been a sound person before, or they're very into audio, it's very difficult to sort of have them express exactly what they want.
Yeah, definitely.
So I've had you on that because I've said, like, right, since you are a sound designer, I wanted to think of movies that really played with sound design. And this happens to be Bavarian Sound Studio by Peter Strickland, a 2012 British psychological horror about a Foley artist and sound designer who goes slowly mad after trying to do the sound design for a 1970s giallo movie. This is the first time you've seen the film. So what do you think about it?
I really like it. I really like. It's a more mod. It has elements of classic horror, but it also combines more recent horror, sort of horror elements that make it a bit more sort of supernatural and eerie and otherworldly. And as a sound design, there's a lot of things where it speaks to my heart, where I'm just like, okay, yeah, I've had to do that before. That's great. And if you're, especially if you're like a audio gear nerd per se,
yes,
this is just like heaven for you. You get to see all this vintage 70s gear, like Watkins copycats and Revox devices and Agro, all this really cool stuff. And it's just a treasure trove of just microphones. And especially Toby Jones's performance, where he, like, you know, he's all these, like, one character says to him, it's like, you've got all these, like, little names for your microphones and stuff. It's like, yeah, we do. We know these things. Like, we know these words and these little key details where people just come in and go, it's like, oh, that's just a cool, professional-looking microphone. It's all thin and metal. And we're like, yeah, no, that's just an AKG C61, etc. And it's just, it just speaks to me on a more personal level, but it's also a great film for also just non-audio people as well.
Yeah, it feels it does well as a sound nerd, you can see like, oh, this is using a particular thing, and also that there, it shows that the directors themselves actually did do a little bit of the research and really looked into the older mechanics of what would be something from the 70s. I mean, this movie actually started off as a version in 2005 as a short film and then expanded onto this afterwards. So he really, it also, if you look at any of other Peter Strickland's work in future, he really does love sound design.
It started as a joke. I entered this competition for Cobra Beer. We had to do like a 1 minute ident. So with the Bowman brothers, we did them, these Foley artists from the kind of the William Castle period, doing that kind of schlocky horror film. After we shot Cutland Varga, I thought, actually, we can go somewhere else with this. We can go somewhere much, much darker. But also, I think just doing the opposite of a film, where a film hides all the mechanics, it's all about the illusion, this was the opposite, really. Looking to how we are complicit in violence, but without being didactic about it. Look at performance. Look at the physicality of sound, how you... physically, your throat hurts after screaming so much. All these elements, you know, the vegetables, you know, that's like a physical manifestation of that sound. How sound was when it was analog, how you had dubbing charts, how you had tape loops, which are physical, all that equipment in a room, which now you can put on one app, probably.
What? So let's actually start by roughly with the beginning of the movie, looking at Toby Jones himself, because Toby Jones, he's basically a British sound engineer who is hired by an Italian studio who has to fly all the way to Italy to do this piece. Like, he was almost like personally asked to do it. So he then goes over to Italy to almost like a hired gun, but with like no connection, doesn't even know what he's doing. And he's kind of thrown into the deep end of that. How do you feel, like, especially the scene that catches me first is the first scene when he goes to the receptionist, and everyone there kind of treats him in a very weird way. They treat him like crap, but also treat him like, some people treat him like he's the golden goose, and it's very peculiar.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a bit more like objectification, where he's basically only been hired for his services as a really good sound designer. Whereas, whenever people try and have a nice conversational communication, obviously they're doing a lot of the legwork and a lot of the lead work and wanting it to serve it in their own way and not giving Toby Jones's Gilroy a chance to speak. Like, he's also like very timid as well. And I think they're playing into that. And obviously, they're these big, brash Italian characters who are probably they say what they feel and stuff like that. And because of that, they're using it to sort of lead and steer the conversations and, you know, almost treating kind of Toby Jones' character like a really nice piece of equipment, where it's like, it's great that we have you here, but we personally, we're not going to give too a huge amount of what you think. We just kind of, we paid you to do a job and you come here and do that.
Anima di Cristo, santifica anche me. What's your problem? What's your problem?
I can't do this stuff.
Gildro, you're here to do a job. Now you do what I tell you. It is just a film. You're part of it. You can see how all this is put together. What's your problem with this?
Maybe it's best to go home.
Gildro, let me just tell you what it is. To be a professional, it's very simple. You cooperate, You don't question. You don't argue. You don't look at your watch. You just do the work you're told to do and keep your personal opinion where it belongs. Am I clear?
There's moments where he discusses and actually sort of says, like, well, we don't actually... he'd have an idea and say, like, maybe we should approach it this way, or do we need this, or do we actually need that? And he's instantly shut down, particularly by the director, who is an absolute caricature. He is the ultimate caricature of what the auteur director is, even though he's making quite literally schlock. He's making the most grotesque kind of movie. And I love the scene where he talks about and mentions the idea, like, it's like saying, where Toby Jones says what it is, it's a horror movie. And he says, like, don't you dare call this a horror movie. This is a violent melodrama. This is a other words other than the word horror, because it feels like horror is kind of a dirty word.
Yeah, because he says a lot like this is a Santiago, like he's the character type of that sort of director who has his vision, if you will. And you can't put his vision into defined genres and stuff like this. So he gets really offended, obviously, when Toby Jones is like, I've not really worked on a horror film before. He's like, it's not a horror film. It's this standard. And therefore, like, Toby Jones' character, he's like, okay, yep, that's fine. Okay, I'm sorry. Slip of the tongue.
What's going on?
Just another scene with Veronica. Can I use her imagination on?
Speaking of scenes, I was going to ask you what about the film.
Hey, what do you mean?
Like, just to know a bit about what happens.
No, Santini's beast. It's okay. Francesco. This is a very specific vision. But you must help me, Gilderoy. It's something I want you to respect.
It's not that, it's just... I've never worked on a horror film before.
Horror film? This is not a horror film. This is not a horror film. This is a Santini film.
True. Santini film is violence, I know. Ma questa è la vita.
This is the life. This is part of the human condition. Please, please, Gilderoy. Don't call my film horror again.
Slip the tongue.
Don't worry, it's okay.
My question is, do you think that this is, well, I wouldn't say it's an accurate representation, but do we feel like this is somewhat of an exaggerated sort of semi-autobiographical idea of how filmmaking is at this point?
I'd say, yeah, to an extent. Obviously, I feel like the circumstances that our lead has been put in are very, very, like, extreme circumstances. Like, a lot of the time, you wouldn't fly out to different countries unless, like, you know, everything was paid for. There's another point in the movie where I can get to that. But, like, obviously, like, he's a British sound designer who's very timid, and he's obviously in this... He's in Italy, he's in this studio where everyone mostly speaks Italian.
Yeah.
But for the most part, as a representation role of a sound designer, I'd say almost, almost. That's what I can describe it.
It does feel like a moment where it's like, you know, because the sound is, it's weird because in this case, the sound design is incredibly important in the movie. It's the big flux of it. It's the big thing. And the director is overseeing a lot of it, which is almost kind of, I wouldn't say it's rare, but he's there every day in the studio, almost checking on him that he's not going to fumble this exact thing. He's almost like a Kubrick in his design, where Kubrick was famous for literally just sort of overseeing everything and making, and sometimes he would do multiple takes of things just because he wasn't happy with one slight movement. Same with also Terry Gilliam. There's a whole bunch of famous directors who are just saying, like, we've got to do this again because this is not how I do it.
No.
So could we say that the Italian director is kind of that vehicle? Like, he represents that?
Yeah. Because he definitely comes in and he has these ideas and, you know, these things that he wants to implant. And he's always, like, basically, again, as I go into the idea that Toby Jones' character is objectified, he's coming in to make sure that his thing that he's paying for is working and that he's doing what he's supposed to be doing.
Sound design is a very fudged up position And so if we have to admit, like, this is a weird job, trying to explain to people what your job is to a point, like, yeah, I fix sound. It's like, so is this, this, and this, what do you do? Oh, I also like destroy vegetables to make, trying to find the perfect sound of wind, or we do, or we're trying to make sure something sounds a little bit more like this when really it sounds like this. And for most people's ears, like, that sounds like fine. It's like, no, it's not fine.
No, it's not right. It's not right. I notice it. And they're like, no, it's fine. Like, they won't notice. It's like, I notice. Someone else will notice.
And you know what? That's leading into the whole thesis of the movie, almost this obsessiveness to be sure you get it done properly and right to the standards that you want. And that's Toby Jones slowly becoming obsessed with trying to get this movie done properly.
What was it?
Can you play it again?
Giovanni!
The obsession is basically, sound designers have to be very nitpicky and obsessive because it needs to be sure that it sounds right. And when a movie does have bad sound design, you can tell.
Yeah, you can. I was speaking to someone like this the other day where basically there's very rare movies with bad sound design.
Yeah.
Like, well, very rare mainstream movies with bad sound design. Sound is such a crucial part that you can only really ever get right with smaller details and things. And, you know, because obviously when you're in the studio, you're obsessively trying to get the right thing for everything. And obviously, like, there's some films where sound design may be a bit more easy process or a bit more complicated process. But nevertheless, you're trying to, you know, you get it to a standard and you have to meet that standard. If you can't, you can't fall underneath it.
And yeah, and that requires then these weird tiny obsessions, like what we talked about at the very beginning, with things like having the different kinds of microphones, things that work, different piece of equipment, walking through town and going, that's a weird sound, let me record that. just getting a sound library up and ready. And it becomes this wonderful hobby that turns into, and it's interesting that this sort of weird sort of thing is now a job.
Definitely. Or speaking of like it being a hobby, there's scenes where Toby Jones comes back and he listens to recordings he has from home, and he'll say like doorbell being recorded on Nagro recorder with AKG C96, and it's just like 2 minutes of just this doorbell being pressed, and it's because he enjoys the sound of it. And it's, especially I think for him as well, that's his escape when he comes back from the studio. He's like, he's listened to all this, you know, horrible noises, brain splattering, people falling out of windows. And he comes home and he's like, I like this doorbell sound.
And we've done that. Like, there's moments where if we really like the idea, the sound of something, we kind of say, like, do we have something we can record this with? Because it's nice. It's a nice thing to have in your library.
Mantle clock, Nagra 4D tape recorder, and AKG C61 microphone.
I've been in the exact same position as Toby Jones has, where a relative I knew had an old Bakelite rotary phone. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, do you mind if I come with all my equipment and I just record this? Like, I'm just going to record, like, me picking up, putting it down, doing the dials on it, you know, getting its ringer with its base plate, putting it on a piece of wood, taking it, the base plate off the piece of wood, and just having it, like, taking it off and getting the actual two bells and just recording them. And I was like, do you mind if I just do this? Like, and they're like, oh, why? Like, it's just a phone. I'm like, yeah, but it sounds nice. And I like to get, yeah. And it's really pleasing.
It's weird. It's like we're hoarders of sound. It was like, you never know when we need a rotisserie phone. We don't know when we need this. We don't know when we need that clinking sound. We never know when you need it.
But it's very handy to have.
I didn't know that you could change my voice so much.
Have you ever heard yourself in one of these before?
Quarter inch, whatever the film is.
You never stopped to ask Santini or Francesco why they hired you. It doesn't make you curious.
Other moments I really enjoyed was stuff like where he's sitting down and he's like, he's playing with the Watkins copycat, getting those really nice echoey delays on that woman's voice to make it really ethereal on me. And that woman comes in and goes like, oh, that's really nice. Mm. That's good. And obviously she sees his true potential and what he can like, how he can enhance these recordings.
Yeah.
And that's a really stand-up moment for me because I'm like, that's what kind of being a sound designer is about. It's a very arty job. You have to have fun with it. And I feel like if your heart's not in the right place, it's not something you can necessarily easily do.
Yeah, you can't go into a project as blindly as what Toby Jones has done in this and do it coldly, because you need, it shows that there needs to be a passion. And when you do something right, you kind of want that that confirmation of saying like, hey, you did good.
Yeah, definitely. You really want that sort of affirmation of like, you know, someone acknowledging your skill and your talents and your creativity.
Yeah,
that's all I live for, man.
Yeah, we just want to be loved. Yeah. We just want to be told that we're doing a good job and a pat on the head.
Good job, Gilderoy.
The overall look of the film's interesting because it's a period piece and really kind of feels like a period piece. And even, but the camera work isn't following anything like a period piece.
No, it isn't. It's all really modern shots and more sort of modern cinematography, especially before, obviously, when it's not the same screen, but obviously when a girl's in the focal booth and she's doing this scream and the camera's pulling away, you can see her surrounded by darkness. And that's a really good modern sort of cinematography technique and looks fantastic.
And it complements more the horror of the sound that comes with it. Everything here seems about, everything's visually shot to make the sound sound worse.
Yes.
To sound nastier and haunting and scary. And a lot of the visual works with that is almost like, there are some very clever transitions between scenes. I sat there thinking, I didn't even realize we moved rooms, let alone anything else. Like every time it jumps back into the apartment and going back and forth between the apartment and the studio, and the apartment being this dank place and him just working at home, but also having moments where things are starting up on their own and things are molding and melding together. It's wonderfully shot.
It's wonderful. It's really good. Yeah, it feels more like Wesley when the cinematographer goes into it, even more thinking about, okay, well, how is this going to sound in the process? Or what's that? What's our pre-thought for how this is going to be in the post-production? And I say a similar sort of director who does that is Edgar Wright.
Yes.
I know it's a very, like, he's very sound-centric, especially with stuff like Baby Driver. Yeah. Where, like, you can feel those quick close-ups that last about a second of, like, you know, a gear lever being shifted or a, you know, brake pedal being pressed. Like, it wasn't there just to be snappy and just to, like, to enhance the action. But you can tell that he was thinking, okay, and now this sound effect is going to punctuate this moment.
And it's just nice to see, again, that Peter Strickland's done the same thing here, where he's saying, like, look, this is a movie about sound. So, technically, the sound has to come first. And so we have our ideas. This is what we want to do for the sound. I wouldn't be surprised if I read through the script and realized most of it was sound direction.
Definitely. I wouldn't be surprised either.
It's like, this is how it works. And then all of it's sound direction. And then basically he's given to the cinematographer saying, this is how it's going to sound like. You need to complement this. It's like, well, okay. This is a turn.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, here's my question. What do you think the movie's about? As in terms of the actual Giallo movie that the director's making.
So the Giallo, the movie within the movie, that's about. So I feel like that movie's basically, like, you know, it's about obviously these, like, nuns and devils and witches. Again, the thing is, you don't ever see it coherently, and you don't see it on screen, which is, again, they really want to drive into sound design by only showing you the hearing, showing you, only letting you hear the audio and never seeing what's played on screen, apart from, like, the opening credits. The opening credits seems like this. It, on the surface, it seems like a horror piece with, like, Italian yellow horror piece with, you know, like, really grotesque scenes and pretty much almost bordering on the lines of torture pornography, I would say.
Yeah.
So there's these really, like, there's these scenarios in the film which you're like, you've not just thought of that off the off chance in terms of the narrative. You've been really focusing on it. Like, you know, witches' hairs being pulled, nun sisters falling out of windows and things like that. So, yeah, it's just, obviously, I feel like we don't really ever get a clear explanation from Santini about what this film's supposed to be. But from Toby Jones and, obviously, after the audience perspective, it's just this really grotesque horror piece.
The more you look, the more the thing continues, the more curious you're of the movie. But because it's out of context, like, it's I think it's almost better that way, that we never find out about what the film's about. Because what it kind of does is, I think this improves a very most important thing, is because we don't see any of the visuals, I feel like all the sound design has improved into it. I mean, there's one famous scene, it's almost on the poster, where you have what looks like one of the female leads doing this horrendously terrifying scream into the mic, and that long take of her eyes bulging out and just trying to recreate this, literally this death call. Sounds more terrifying if we imagine where it's connected to than if we actually saw the image that the sound was coming from. Hello again, and welcome to the Enigmatic Insert, where I will take you aside and help analyse any key terms and theories that we may stumble upon in our review. Now, one of the elements that I adore about sound is how people respond to it. As we were discussing before, it plays a very key part in developing a cinematic soundscape ideal to get the right reaction to a scene. But how does that work? Well, this can be examined through a branch of psychoacoustics, the science of auditory psychology. This is the linking point between how the physics of sound affects the human ears and the perceptive reaction caused by those sounds to the human brain, whether it's volume, frequency, pitch, repetition, localization, or even cultural impact. Hearing is not a purely mechanical phenomenon, but seen as a multi-sensory experience, enhanced by how it is transformed into physical and neural actions and then translated into established meaning of that sound. Sometimes a reaction to a sound is through a reflex or conditioning, such as a fire alarm. Others are emotionally connected or have musicality to them, such as hearing your favorite song on the radio. But others can cause a reaction that can spark imagery, which is what sound designers focus on. A person can associate key sounds with a physical image of a place, object, person, or event, having our minds already connect them together and provide an image to prepare ourselves of what is ahead, establishing a sense of reality and knowingness. But cinema doesn't necessarily do that. As many of you know, a lot of sound is recorded later, using alternatives to give the perception of a sound rather than an accurate representation. Kara Scott James, in their book Sound Design for Moving Image, From Concept to Realization, describes this process of developing soundscapes as sonic deconstruction and sonic sculpting, suggesting that through breaking down what makes a sound connect to the viewer and then changing its source while still maintaining the same profile such as pitch, frequency, and texture creates a whole new hyperreality that connects with more clarity. This, alongside repetition, culture, and our own experiences, can then trick our brains to believe that the sound of a smashing melon on a stone slab in a studio is a human skull cracking after a terrible long fall. The audience can hear those terrible sounds from the film within a film without the visual, but can still imagine the worst. We'll continue with this further, discussing how our own fears also add to the terrifying imagery connected to these soundscapes.
I think that we all have like a inbuilt fear of the unknown. Mm. And the idea, like, we only get told about what these things are of context, and we have to, our imaginations have to imagine, oh, what kind of film is this? What are they actually making? What is, because obviously, and then you go into when they're doing the Foley scenes as well, when they're making all these gory sounds by tearing up lettuces and squashing tomatoes, ripping stems out and throwing mangoes on the floor to make these horrible squishy sounds and stuff like this. Mm. And you're like, well, it gives you two thoughts. One, wow, this is really, you know, shocking film they're making. And two, all these people that are making it, apart from the main lead, are really desensitized to what they've been making as well. Because there's those two Foley engineers, Massimo and Massimo, who just sort of like, they come on and they just perform and they get it. They've done it, like, they do it like it's a routine at this point, and it's habit that they know what to do.
Yeah, it's like I say, look, this is a Santini film. We've done this many a time. This isn't our first trip to the ballpark. And that's scary, thinking about how this is basically almost, this is almost a commentary of the desensitization of some of horror. And Toby Jones is sort of there because it's the first time seeing like, this is horrendous.
Toby Jones's lead obviously hasn't done anything like this. Yeah. So, and it shows in his behavior and, you know, his uncomfortableness when you do it. Yeah, you know, he misses cues because he's so shocked by what he's seeing. But, you know, it's rare in most horror films that, like, you do that amount of work to get that kind of effect. So, and everyone's attitude to it, as well as their dialogue and their talking about it, makes it seem like it's really no big deal.
Mm.
Except it's gruesome and it's horrifying for like everybody, like from Toby Jones' point, we're seeing it as this really horrifying thing. So it's just, it's so desensitized where it comes off almost, they're scary in themselves.
Yeah, they almost become the real monsters in this piece.
Also, additionally, like, he must be so like confused about the narrative. And as a sound designer, it's personally my case, your main job is kind of to enhance the narrative of the film. You're working to that story. You're not working on a technical level. You're going, okay, how can I make this scene more engaging for the audience? Yeah. So I feel like he must be so confused with doing his job. Mm. Like, with sound effects, that you can get a basic understanding of that, but he has no idea of the story, and so therefore I feel like it hinders his job a little bit.
The Italians are very renowned for not recording any sound on set because they believe it's a quicker turnaround to just film everything and then add everything later, which is why if you look in movies from Italian films from the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s in particular, everything's dubbed, everything's a sound effect afterwards. So, and on top of that, it does feel like he's not doing the movie in order either. It's jumping back and forth. So he's now, the reason why he's probably feeling even more desensitized, not desensitized by it, is because he's got the whole thing out of context.
Yeah.
And so he's now doing like, here's a stabby scene, here is a shouty scene, this is a deaf scene, and this is a moment of dialogue mixed in with this in a different language. Nothing makes sense in context.
And as you were saying before, as he further goes into the film, he starts getting, I wouldn't say used to it, but more content with it, more like he's kind of accepted his role.
Yeah.
And there's a really good scene that really emphasises this, where it's someone falling out of a window and the sound, the Foley artists, you know, they ruffle like a piece of cloth to get the sound of clothes falling down out the window, and then they squash a mango.
Yeah.
And the first time they do it, Toby Jones goes, it sounds too watery. Can we get more of a ripe or firmer mango?
Sounds a little little watery. Is there any fresh marrow?
Bobina 2, scena 25, ripresa 5.
La strega sorprende Monica nel sonno e la lancia fuori dalla finestra del dormitorio.
Now here's the question. That's a really ambiguous scene, because there's two things. Like, we do that as sound designers as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know if ever he's doing this from a performance and a job sort of point of view, or whether he wants to get more of a realistic sound and grotesque sound because he wants to, he's desensitized it by to this at this point, and he's like, you know, trying to get more of the effect and the same mindset as his producer and other co-workers.
Yeah, and it's the thing as well, is like, obviously as well, from the first few days, you know, he's been basically been bullied by the director. So maybe by this point is now him trying to up his game and thinking like, maybe I am being soft. Maybe I do need to think about this. Maybe I do need to take this more seriously, because I am not, because it's so out of my comfort zone that I feel like I should be embracing this thing.
Yeah, definitely. And especially when, I think there's a scene as well where one of the Italian voice dubbers talks to him, and, you know, she's saying to him, like, you're not going to get what you want by just, you know, standing there and just sort of like complaining and being timid about it. You need to, in this place, we need to be a bit more sort of brash and a bit more stronger, and be like, you have to really speak and shout your mind.
How are you getting on with Santini?
All right.
Really? I overheard you trying to get your money back for the flight. If you talk to people like that, you'll never get anywhere in this place.
Why? So being rude?
That's exactly it. You should be rude. Nobody pays money here unless they have to.
I have asked several times.
You don't just ask here. You shake your fists, you shout, you push these pigs until you get them into the corner. Be careful with Santini. That baby smile is there for a reason. You don't see that?
And then after that, you notice there's a definite body language and change in his misdemeanor in the studio, where he's like, no, we're going to do this, or, you know, being a bit more, what's the word, forward.
And it's a fascinating almost turn where we slowly turn into it and becomes this different person, and it really becomes a different person as we slowly start delving into the end. I don't know what to think about the ending, because I feel like literally in the last 20 minutes of the movie shifts, because he has what seems to be like a psychotic break that, like, I think is burnout, overworking, everything else, just really putting his effort to make this damn movie good. And he has this sort of mental breakdown where it's such a weird scene where he's going through the studio and there's entities and what feels like almost like a supernatural element to it. And then the movie just goes back to normal. But then everything's in Italian.
Yes. I like that scene. I do like that scene. Because obviously, it's a bit where afterwards he feels like he's in a dream, and then he goes into the studio and sees literally the moment before, but on the projector.
Yeah.
And he's on the other end of that door. And I feel like that signifies this change into his position at the end, where I feel like, personally, my kind of, I'm not understanding of, again, it's very vague, but my sort of takeaway from this end of the film is that, obviously, he's now become one of them. And he's repeatedly, infinitely trapped in this loop, because he's doing the same thing that he would do to the people on the screen, where he's deafening that girl to try and get a better performance. Yeah. And in turn, that girl's going, I've had enough of this, I don't want to be treated like that, walks out. And that cycle just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going, where he's now part of the film in a way.
Yeah, he's become part of the process. And arguably, and the scariest thing is, he's now become just as almost as bad, or just as more so, as the arrogant director.
My throat's better now.
We've moved on to Foley.
Can I? Just once more.
Which reel?
Forget the reel. I just need to scream. That's all. he used me. I knew he would. I try my best to do my work, and it's never good enough. It always comes to the same thing. I'm just a whore to them. Nothing more. I said no. I said no so many times. He kept touching me here. I feel so cheap, Gildroy. I feel so dirty and cheap.
Stanotte metterò in atto la mia vendetta e mostrerò a Santini qual è la vera maledizione. Stanotte distruggerò la cosa che ha più cara e ridurrò quel bastardo in ginocchio. Te lo prometto.
You actually just want to mention something. All the females in this movie, especially the female voice actors, are treated appallingly.
They are. They really are.
And it's also, I think, leading to the idea of this sort of, it's a very 70s idea that, you know, the overtly just, you know, again, being a hired gun in this case, but in this case, the female characters who are doing the voiceovers and doing the dialogue and doing the screams are having to relive a trauma over and over again by reenacting this trauma, because that is the art of dubbing in this case. This is the art of dubbing or looping or ADR. And the act of ADR is a weird one.
Yes, definitely. Like, you have to pretty much... It's a bizarre process where, like, obviously, again, the point you've said before, Italian films don't record with sound. It's just trying to get a quick turnaround. And obviously, they have to put themselves into that mindset. And it comes to a point where you basically are part of that process and you are in line with the character and what's happening to them as well. Because you're repeatedly doing it. You're sat in a booth, and if it's like a screaming scene, you're saying this, you're having to say it over and over and over until you're exactly right and your same motivation and delivery is there.
Filmmaking, especially if you're looking at some of the movies that are about strong subjects, it's the idea of presenting trauma to an audience. And the scary thing is, once it's made, it's out there and people can see this trauma over and over and over again. And this is where it could lead to like the desensitization or having this sort of terrible time with it. And through the filmmaking process, sometimes you are having to relive this horror, these things over and over again. And it's a hard sit to think about. And this is why I think what the female characters represent is the idea of film is about presenting ideas and themes and scenarios to an audience. And it's about figuring out whether or not we as an audience want to see this or want to see this presented to us. But do we want to keep reliving that again? Because now that's preserved. That movie's out there for everyone to see. So with giallo movies, for example, which are famous for having incredibly nasty gore, do we want to keep watching that over and over again? I've become desensitized to it. Or are we like the women saying, look, I don't want to live through that again. That was horrendous. I don't want to do that again. Especially things like the actors, actresses, voice actors. Anyone who has to keep doing this over and over again.
Beautiful long hair. And now face just like a ghost. It is a tragedy to lose hers.
How many more scenes like this? It's just... Sorry. It's interrogations.
These things happen. Yes. This is history. And a film director must be true. I hate what they did to this beautiful woman. Really, I hate it. But it is my duty to show. The world must know the truth. And see the truth. I end it.
Hey, what? Don't you just forget it?
Usually I like to add some, I like to do something which is called the elevator pitch. Hmm. So if we were going to pitch this to someone who's never seen this movie before in a couple of sentences, how would we do it?
Mine would require a person knowing a film, but I would say something like Videodrome, but with sound.
I'm with the new flesh.
That would be me. If I had to not use a film, I would say something like, it's a really good obsessive horror look into the sound design industry and how hard it is to perform it.
Yeah. Basically, although Videodrome but sound should be the goddamn tagline for this movie. It's Videodrome but sound.
That's my main takeaway from it. And it's like, whenever I watch a film, I always try and compare it to another film. I'm just like, just has the same obsessive and desensitized qualities as Videodrome but sound. And I love it.
Oh, that's absolutely excellent. And that, what a way to end that. So, this has been lovely. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And so that's the end of our review of Peter Strickland's Barbarian Sound Studio, and thank you all very much for listening to this lovely episode. This was a lot of fun to do, and hopefully not only introduced you to this great film, but also allowed a little more insight into the weird and wonderful process behind sound design. Will was a real delight, and I'll likely bring him back on again for another Audiotastic Appreciation episode. Can't wait. Would you guys want me to bring in more film specialists and film roles as guests on the show? If so, please provide suggestions to us on social media. We always want to hear from other cinephiles and those in the movie industry, so please drop a comment. And with that, this essay is closed. And we'll return soon for another not-so-trash review. See you all next time, cinephiles. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode and hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it around with movie lovers you know, maybe add a star rating or write a good review. All of this helps with the algorithm and provides us with more opportunities to reach the ears to a whole new bunch of bad film fanatics. Want to find out more about us? Then head over to our socials where we provide sneak peeks and up-to-date news on everything nostalgic and trashy. You can find our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages in the description, so please follow us. See you next time, cinephiles.